Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and a co-chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum. I will be your chair for tonight's program, Show Me the Funny, Hollywood's top comedy writers with Jeffrey Davis. Among his hit shows are Love Boat, House Calls, and Lynn Redgrave's Give Me a Break, and Night Court, which was one of my and is one of my favorites. Joining Jeffrey tonight in laughs and comedy, and I can guarantee you it will be a night of laughs and comedy, is Peter Desberg, famous for combining writing, researching, and consulting on business and humor. Their book, which they will sign for you tonight, is entitled Show Me the Funny, Hollywood's Top Comedy Writers. And it will be on sale outside tonight after our meeting closes, and they will be here to sign the book for you. We're going to go right into the meeting because you will have lots more fun with them than you will have with me just making announcements. So here you are. Here are Jeffrey and Peter. And we will begin the meeting with them.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Ann. So, okay. What's that? Oh, smaller people. Okay. Good evening, and thank you for having us. You can tell that neither of us have rented a tie this evening, so we're not formal people. Peter loves that joke. He always makes me do it. We're here to talk about comedy, and we're here to talk about how comedy writers think differently than other people. Please interrupt us, ask questions. There are no rules here tonight. We're here to have a good time. So, Peter.
Yeah.
Good evening, Peter Desper. Yeah. This is radio.
We're very interested in how comedy writers work and how a comedy works. So, we know that comedy writers aren't like most people. They think in a very different way. Let me give you an example. We interviewed a man named Elliot Schoenman, who was the showrunner for Home Improvement. He told us that he was writing a book about his father. His father was a stockbroker in New York and committed suicide. So at one point he decided he was going to go back to New York, get his sister who lived there, and they were going to recreate his father's cab ride from his office to the bridge where he jumped. So we're in the cab, and you can't imagine a heavier emotional moment. And as they're riding there at this point, he starts thinking, my dad was a German Jew and kind of cheap. I wonder how much he tipped the cab driver on the way to his own suicide. People just kind of go to a different place.
So you can all hear me? That's wonderful. You know, I don't normally work with animals and children, so there's a dog here in the front. It's wonderful. Probably get a good laugh or two from the dog. We have hundreds of books in bookshelves and bookstores and libraries about the process of comedy writing. But it's usually, I guess the best of these books would be the Paris Review interviews, made famous by George Plimpton. But they're really about how someone thinks they wrote, not showing them writing. And we wanted to see exactly how people do it. So, you know, we think that sometimes things get romanticized.
Yeah, when you ask somebody, how did you do what you did? Sometimes the memory is a little hazy. Sometimes you want to make what you do sound a little better. There's a great phrase, the highest form of fiction is the autobiography. So we didn't really want to run into that. So what we did was Jeffrey and I wrote a little sitcom premise, and we gave it to each of these incredible writers that we worked with, and we said, develop it. Show us how you work. So we actually got to sit down next to these incredible people, and they made stuff up on the spot. So we were sitting there watching the creative process unfurl. And, you know, my background is kind of as a boring science guy. And what made it really interesting for me was we believe in the idea of separation and control of variables. So here was every writer starting at the exact same place, and we got to see where they went with it and how they did it differently. And what was particularly wonderful as they did this was every one of these writers would not only just do something incredibly different, as we'll get into later, but a lot of them narrated what they did. And we'll tell you a little more about how they came up with stuff, but it was great because not only were they creating stuff, but sometimes they were saying, well, you know, I'm thinking of this, I got to solve this problem here, I guess I would do this. So literally you're in their heads watching this.
So what we did is sometimes we just let them go, or if they wanted us to participate, we made ourselves part of the writer's room. If you look carefully, there we are.
No sense of shame. But what was interesting was that a few of the writers actually worked in teams, and mostly we just tried to keep out of their way. But sometimes somebody would sit there and sort of think, and then Jeffrey would ask him a question, we'd make a suggestion, and all of a sudden, oh, and then off they go to the races again, which was pretty much the dynamic that you have only with a writer's room. You've got 6, 8, 10 people doing this and stimulating one another. So it's a really interesting process to watch these people do stuff.
So there are different roles in the writer's room. There's the showrunner, obviously, who doesn't spend all that much time in the writer's room because he or she is doing other things. This is the room monkey. The room monkey is probably the most important person in the room because when the energy, you know, in writer's rooms they work between 12 and 14 hours a day. If it's a good show, they have good food, keep them going. But there's always going to be a moment in the day when the energy flags, and they need this person. In this case, it's a gentleman by the name of Lou Schneider, who was on, among other things, Everybody Loves Raymond. Lou would go over and make love to the thermostat, get a lot of laughs. I could say hump the thermostat, but I don't think this is the right group for that. That's what he said. I didn't say that. And then they would say, come back to the table because we need your creativity. But by then, people were feeling better and they could get back to work. That's why comedy writers get paid a lot of money, I think.
Yes.
When they're going through the thought process, who's actually recording the good jokes and screening things out? Or do you just record everything and then somebody goes through later? How does that
They pretty much have a kind of a spaghetti against the wall process on most shows. You just spitball and just keep. It's not just jokes. They go through. Usually by the second draft, you're going line for line and seeing where the joke is just a joke and doesn't advance the story, because the great writers know that if a joke is just a joke and doesn't, you know, enlighten us about character or story, it goes out. So they actually have a writer's assistant.
Speaking to the mic.
Oh, all right. They have a writer's assistant. Several of my students former students are doing that right now. It's a great way to get into the industry. Yes, and they put everything up on the computer these days. So, who else? Well, I like to run. I'm needing exercise.
He needs the exercise, so bring him over.
Okay. Don't be shy, Sonia.
One of the interesting things, the story about the room monkey and Lou was actually told to us by Phil Rosenthal, who was the showrunner on Everybody Loves Raymond. And he said he loved Lou because, again, Lou would take that role. Lou was a stand-up. And he said, I was so glad to have Lou because I used to be the room monkey. And one of the things that the writers kept telling us was, you know, we're used to giving a lot of interviews, but we find we're telling you stories we don't usually tell because of the unusual nature of what you're asking us to do. So different stuff was coming out. I'll give you an example here. One of the people we interviewed was Peter Casey, who was the co-creator of Wings and Frasier. And he told us a story about how they came up with Frasier. And many of you know, Frasier was a spin-off character from Cheers, and he was kind of a loser on Cheers. And so here they remade the character. He was now moving to Seattle, He had his own radio show, which made him kind of a minor celebrity in the city. He was a successful psychiatrist, so he could afford to get a really plum apartment with an incredible city view. He got the best designer to make a perfect-looking apartment for him. Every color harmonized, every piece of furniture was perfect. And then just before he moves in, or is ready to, Dad moves in. And what's the first thing that Dad does? Brings his recliner. And Peter was telling us that recliner was treated like a character on the show. It says, first of all, we had interior designers come in and pitch the ugliest recliners they could find. Then they found the worst pattern that they could find. Then they brought in a swatch book of just this pattern in different colors to make it clash as much as possible. And the role of this chair was every time Frazier would walk into his beautiful new apartment, the chair would say, remember that life you carefully planned to make so wonderful? I'm here to make sure none of that happens for you. I'm here to wreck every plan that you've ever had.
So about this premise that we created, just briefly, in the interest of time, it's about a grown daughter whose mother loses all her money, the father dies suddenly, loses all her money, and has to move in with her daughter. And we purposely did not give them a lot of detail. We also had a sort of a subplot about grandparents who are more like their granddaughter than the mother, who's kind of a old hippie. And so we said there are no rules. You can do anything to this premise you want. You can change the sex. You can make it a father-daughter. You can make it to a father-son. And that's what they did. And so you're getting 25 different stories out of this one premise. And that's the fun of the book. And you're also, we've been using it, a lot of students are now using it in classrooms, because I think it's a little bit of a different way to look at how writing is done. Most writing books are, this is the way you do it. And these writers are, you know, they're the stars of the book. And they're saying there's as many ways to do it as there are writers. It's kind of exciting.
So here are just a few of the people that we got to interview and some of the major works that they did.
Peter, I don't think this is a good sign. The dog is sleeping.
No, he's contemplating.
I want the dog to get up and do some jokes and earn its...
He's thinking.
Oh. So.
So, you know, again, Jeffrey... is too modest to tell you, but he's the chair of the screenwriting program at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. And there's always a question about how do you teach screenwriting? And there are a number of books out that literally will tell you what page something should be happening on, how to structure things. And we like those, right?
Mm-hmm. No, we don't. I'm sorry. I entirely missed my cue. No, we don't like those kind of books.
Because he was being elegantly sarcastic.
They're untrue. And a lot of the people who write those books have actually never written anything. So how would they know?
But the thing that we discovered was that as many writers as we had, that's how many different processes we could find. And it was amazing, again, to watch them. And students have really been in screenwriting programs all over the country are giving us feedback that it's so helpful for them because they're watching so many different ways to tackle writing problems. And they're getting away from this model of, no, there's one way you write. On page 12, there has to be an inciting incident. You know, you have to have your character really clear by page 30. No, by the beginning of the second act, and these guys show, not even close.
So we were wondering which would the writers be most interested in, character or structure or story? And we were wrong on both counts. It was conflict. So, Peter, why don't you talk about the different kinds of conflict? You see how well we work together?
It's like smooth, Mark and Lewis. Very smooth. Well, as long as I'm here, why not, Jeff?
Why not? I mean, we just came off. We have to apologize. We just came off a cruise. Right.
So typically, you know, we think of conflict as two people wanting to duke it out with another. And a lot of comedy is based on pure hostility and nastiness in terms of conflict. But one of our favorite interviews was with a fellow named Leonard Stern, who goes all the way back to the Honeymooners. And he was one of the co-creators of Get Smart with Mel Brooks and Buck Henry. And he was saying, all of my stories, everything I write has conflict in it, but it's conflict that comes out of love. It's never out of hostility. And conflict out of love. And ironically, if you think of just about every I Love Lucy episode, that's what it was. And, you know, comedy writers, besides having incredible gifts and incredible knowledge, just have a bag of tricks also. And sometimes, you know, it's late, I need a laugh, what can I do? Oh, so one of the famous tricks that comedy writers have is they know if you need a cheap laugh, and that's where Jeffrey and I are really experts, is have the telephone ring. And the busier and more awkward the situation, the bigger the laugh. If you come in with three bags of groceries about to spill out and the phone rings, you're going to get a laugh. If this is the time when you and the girlfriend are deciding whether to stay or go and the phone rings. And worse than that is, who is the worst person to call at the most inopportune moment? Mother. Why mother? Well, because she really loves you. And she knows exactly what you should be doing with your life. You also know what you should be doing with your life, and you couldn't clash no harder. And so it's the whole point of, what do you mean you're going to become a writer? I told you to go to pharmacy school. What are you thinking? So again, it's this idea of when you have two people with good intentions, and they start to clash because each one wants you to do the right thing. It's an incredible form of hostility. No, conflict, but out of love. Well, one of the things we found really interesting is these writers really opened up about sort of what you could call the Hollywood establishment. And there's probably in all the arts today, but probably none greater than in the movie industry, we're seeing this aesthetic shift from that's a really beautiful, interesting project to how much money is it going to make? Yeah. And the world of commercialism is very much alive. The stories you hear now about great movies and great ideas on TV taking a decade to make because nobody wants to take a chance on them. And all of a sudden, who knew? This is even happening in the book industry. You know, if any of you are familiar with a book called Chicken Soup for the Soul, every major publisher said, no. They gave them the same look you guys are giving us right now.
We had this...
And then he said, okay, I'll publish it myself. And the rest is pretty much...
One of our writers, Charlie Peters, who has written many, many movies going back to the 80s, said that he knew things were changing when he sat down with a producer. They hadn't even started to outline the script. And the producer said, what do you think it'll be like opening weekend? And Charlie said, oh, I don't know, 60, 65 and rainy? So we just learned all of these wonderful, you know, in addition to getting these great premises, we also learned all these great things about the industry.
Literally, some of these writers said, if I don't get producer or director credit, I'm not writing. Because I'm just not going to have people take my stuff and mess with it. And it's gotten to that extreme that on movies particularly, the idea of taking the script you write and expecting to hear those words and those actions pretty much...
Well, I have a few stories about that, but I'd rather not talk about it. It'll cost me some bills at the psychiatrist. Calling your entire family on the East Coast. I mean, I have a family that's, you know, roughly the size of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and telling them you're having a show on and there's not a comma in the script that you wrote. Oh, my God, it's dead out there. Hello? I can hear you breathing. That's the oldest joke in the world.
So
why don't you talk about darkening?
Why not? We had an interesting experience. We interviewed a man named Bob Meyer, who was the showrunner for Roseanne for several years. And we gave him the premise, and this guy was so good it was scary, a well-oiled machine. He said, okay, got the premise. First thing I do is in my head, I'm casting it. So that way, as I'm writing dialogue, I know exactly what it's going to sound like coming through the mouth of this person. So I can literally picture the person that I'm writing dialogue for. And in like 6-7 minutes, he's got a perfect little episode for network TV. So Jeffrey looked at him and said, that's really nice. Could you darken it? And Bob is kind of a short, let's say, cherubic man. And he got this little impish look on his face and said, how dark do you want it? And literally it was like, here's the dial. Tell me how much to go. And here was this nice story about this 50-ish woman who moves in with her 20th son. And literally, he's just sort of saying, you know, I can make it as light or as dark as you want it. You just tell me where you want it to be. And we're going to introduce you to Bob. This was his, at least a slightly edited version of what he would do to darken the story.
If she were a private detective, for example, good at her work, but, you know, she's a modern Sherlock Holmes. She was a drug addict. You know?
That's true.
So you actually give her the cocaine habit or the heroin habit that she's actually trying to fight. And, you know, I'd take it to a place where, you know, she goes to withdrawal and then lapses. That's how you darken it.
What do you think makes that funny?
Well, it's not tremendously funny.
No, not like, but
I mean, she'd have to be funny. You'd have to, out of her darkness and out of her, quite honestly, out of her self-loathing would be comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if when you hate yourself, you hate the world. Mm-hmm. You know, so she would just hate everybody around her, and anger is funny. The negative emotions I would funny probably, if in the pilot episode, I would probably start the first act where you had no idea of her addiction. You just saw her at work and you saw how good she was. And then at the end of a quarter hour, a half hour, you'd see her make up all her little chemicals to shoot up.
By the way, as you're looking at this, please notice the dog sitting right behind him on that chair.
And you go, whoa.
You know,
then you go to her psychiatrist. And you'd see her lie to her psychiatrist.
The dog, damn it.
Saying that the, you know, the habit is, you know, I haven't done it in days. When you know she probably, you know she did it the night before. She probably did it on her way, you know. So you see her lie, and you're the only one who knows the whole truth. As the audience, you and she are the only ones who know the whole truth about her. And that way, she becomes as dark as you can be. You know, and especially if she hates the world, that means that she has no respect for the world. She'll lie her way through anything, and that can be very funny. You know, trying to get into, for example, the evidence room, and she's just a private detective. And how does she lie her way into that? Because she doesn't care. Mm-hmm. This is a woman who, because of the drug habit, her life is shit, and she doesn't care if she dies tomorrow. But the one thing that keeps her moving is that this is what she's good at. And this is something that she can't. I think her dependency kind of makes her like, first of all, she's funny. You like funny people. Second of all, she's pretty. You like pretty people. Pretty and funny people, you love them. But she's also got a struggle, and you're rooting for her. You know, you want her to survive. You want her to pull out of this. And she is she's good enough at what she does, entertaining enough in how she behaves, that just like she can keep her friends strung along, her friends haven't given up on her yet. You know, you don't either. Because you still feel that there's something of value there. You probably need a Jiminy Cricket in the show. You probably need a sister or somebody who knows enough about her and is constantly sitting on her shoulder. And somebody she lies to. But somebody who was a dear friend, a sister, who would ultimately create, there's obviously an intervention show, right in the middle of an investigation. So she walks in home, she's got, you know, she's got the report about the latent prints and everything, and she, the DNA evidence, and she's coming home just to pick up her hat or whatever it is she needs, obviously her cocaine. She's just coming in, and she's got an interview with a guy that she's got to meet at a certain time, and he's the deep throat, and blah, 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 she walks in, intervention. She can't get out. There's comedy in that.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Bob, this is great. That's great.
I'm thinking of pitching it now. Good God, you guys
got. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and Show Me the Funny, Hollywood's top comedy writers, with Jeffrey Davis and Peter Desberg.
Oh, hello. Welcome back.
By the way, since this is being taped...
Conflict and injury. Are you all right? Oh, good.
Jeffrey, these tantrums have to stop. Since this is being taped and it may be on the radio, try and make your laugh as distinctive as possible so you can hear the lady say, "Do you hear that? That's me." That's
someone actually a little while ago referenced a famous Jack Benny joke that was on the radio. Just to show you influences and things we learned in the book. There's that great, the longest silence in radio history. Your money or your life. So I'll do the joke anyway. Thank you very much for stepping on my line. I appreciate that. I'm struggling here. You're not helping. And the dog, I have to say, is a big impediment. I'm just kidding. I love animals and children. Jack is being held up. He says, "Your money or your life?" There's this long silence. The robber repeats, "Your money or your life?" And there's another long silence, and Jack Benny says, I'm thinking. Now, to show you the influence, Peter's going to tell you about what they did on Roseanne.
So, Bob, the fellow you just saw, told us this story that there was an episode on... First of all, let me contextualize this for you. One of the great skills that every comedy writer has is joke switching. How to take a joke and change it to a different situation so it fits, but it's the same joke. Roseanne is having her third child. She's in a Lamaze class. She remembers the first two and said, I just don't know if I want to go through all that pain again. So she talks to her OBGYN and says, "How about if I get some painkillers this time? How about if we..." Says, "With your weight, you might endanger the health of both the child and yourself. What do you want to do?" "Well, what do you want?" "I'm thinking." Same joke. You could see the origin. Obviously, the writers had known this joke. And recently, by the way, I saw that same joke done on Big Bang Theory. So it's just the same jokes come around. We have a question. Jeffrey.
Oh, hold on. I love this part.
Pass the baton, just like an Olympic runner.
So with the television show, it's clear you're working with a team of writers. It's just the amount of material you have to produce, and just seems like that's the way it goes. But in the feature film, you have, I'm just thinking of like Woody Allen. He's like a lone genius. What about that process? No. Okay. Well, some take a lesser... genius. Yeah, I mean, what's the process there? Is they're not working in a team, and we always usually see one or two writers, but obviously I know there's always more, and people...
There's the evil people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of curious about that process.
There was a time when writers sat down by themselves and wrote.
They're called...
And just, right. Jeffrey, how many writers did they have in that huge writing room on I Love Lucy for all those episodes?
Two writers wrote all of the episodes of I Love Lucy. Bob Carroll and Madeline Pugh. Yeah. Now, as answering your question, sir, just because you're with this beautiful lady and we'll have prizes for you afterward.
I thought she was the prize.
I feel like I'm channeling George Burns tonight. What's happening more and more in films is this evil entity called the executive, which in the old days was a different breed because they loved film. Most of the executives, not by any stretch all of them, come from business schools like Brown or Yale or Harvard, and they don't really know movies. So you have to do, you sit down and do note sessions.
Jeffrey, can I tell the executive joke?
Why don't you, Peter?
A writer and an executive are lost in the desert. This joke came out during the Writers Guild strike a couple of years ago. Writer and an exec are lost in the desert. They're about to expire when they see an oasis in the distance. They both make for it. Naturally, the writer gets there first because he's hungrier. It's a little pool of water. He drops to his knees, cups his hands, and he brings his shaking hands to his mouth. And all of a sudden, he looks to see a stream of yellow liquid coming into his hands. He looks up to see the exec peeing into his hands. He says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm making it better."
Very good. I'm totally off script now. I have nowhere. What's next? Who has more questions? Yay. All right. Ladies first. Okay. I almost hit the dog. Not good.
Are we going to hear tonight the different treatments that different writers gave your premise? How they vary?
We will talk a little bit about some of those, and they're all available in the book itself.
Oh, I see. That's a trick.
Which I'm told is on sale, and for one night only, with Christmas quickly approaching.
Right. Or Hanukkah,
I want you to think of something. If you owned a first edition signed Dickens novel, what would that be worth today? And there were people listening to that and saying, it's just a Dickens book.
Oh, sorry, sir.
If your premise to these writers, pair or team as it might be, if something really good developed from that might fly, who would own that?
What a good question. We had them sign a piece of paper that says we have the right to reprint the interview, but they own everything that they wrote. As writers ourselves, we understand how important it is to be able to have ownership. And several people, probably your next question, because I read eyes, was, did any of these people pitch some of the stuff they did? Several told us that they actually liked the stuff they came up with in the book and pitched it.
Bob did, actually.
Bob was, yeah.
And actually, to answer your question, that's one of the things that came out of the premise. Another one, just before you asked this question, another one was one guy, a young writer named Hank Nelken. Can you all hear me? Oh, for the radio.
Now we can.
Yes. Hello. Hank Nelken, who has written a number of movies.
Saving Silverman.
Right. He decided to throw the daughter out altogether, make the mother a little bit younger, and he wrote a Bernie Madoff story. It was right around the time the whole Bernie Madoff thing was happening, and so it was a revenge story. It was really great. So you could see what people did. Yes, sir, you have a question in the back. The bidding starts at $200,000. I'm sorry, wrong room.
You mentioned Bob, by the way. It almost sounded like he was laying out the plot for the new Sherlock Holmes show, Elementary, in that clip. But as you were doing your interviews with the writers and laying out your premise, how much do you think you might have nudged them or influenced them with the questions you asked in the middle?
Again, it varied. I think I've just basically elucidated the entire premise of creativity right there. So I hope none of you missed that, because that was very important.
I think the only thing I would add to that is that what we wanted, we wanted to replicate the real writer's room. And in a writer's room, the first rule is nobody owns anything. That's another thing that's different from movies. Your credit may be on there with the script, but everybody's helped you. I'll give you an example. Mad Men, I'm sure there's some people in here who watch Mad Men. Almost every single one of those writers comes from sitcoms. So they're including the creator who started on Golden Girls. They do everything together. Somebody eventually has to go out and draft the script, but they do the rewrite in the room. There's no ownership. So you don't really know who did what in the end, and that's the way a good television show should work, I think.
Well, you know, just to tell you the opposite in the writer's room, we got a lot of writer's room stories in there, and some described it like being part of a really wonderful family, down to ones that hated going into the room. And one of our favorite stories, Walt Bennett, who wrote for Cosby, when he was first breaking in, was the young guy in the room, and he pitches a joke, nothing. Now, just like you guys, just... And then 20 minutes later, one of the seasoned writers pitches the exact same joke. Everybody breaks up. And so Walt said, hey, I just pitched that joke. And they said, come on, don't be like that. Trial by fire. One of the questions we asked them, we had a series of questions we asked after they developed the premise, was how do you know if what you wrote was funny? And what was interesting was that a whole lot of the writers had stand-up experience, and a whole lot didn't. And there was a real difference. The guys that did stand-up kind of had a survival instinct, because when you're up there, you know, you got about a half second, and they're going to laugh or you're going to die. And you start to figure out what's going to work. Very different from the people that didn't, the ones that didn't.
Come on, Peter. We're not all asleep here. There's a couple people laughing. So I was just kind of
not
curious.
At the level that I'm expecting, okay?
I really think the dog jokes were special, and I'm just offended. Here we are, guests of this celebrated 100-year-old club, and this is the way you treat us? It's horrible.
I'm just kind of curious what you might suggest if you're developing a script, like a feature script, in terms of, you know, maybe working with somebody, workshopping it, or bouncing it off people, or, you know, taking that, things you might have done, or things that are...
Where are you in the process?
Thinking of one.
Okay. First thing you want to do is you want to do a really crappy first draft. Can I say crappy
on the
radio?
It?
Okay. Really do. It's really important. As a writer, I really love a San Francisco writer, Anne Lamott. If anybody wants to get a great book, it's called Bird by Bird. And she talks about the obligation of writers to write a bad first draft, to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
Then you want to show it to people. You want to workshop it. And the agent manager thing is the very last thing you do. You got to get about 15 drafts, I think.
Really?
Yeah. That's with young people with whom I work on a daily basis. It's not enough. I have two of my own children. They think one or two drafts is it. And any professional writer will tell you it's a minimum of 15 drafts. My favorite story about this is, really quickly, is L.A. Confidential, which I think everybody here would acknowledge is a great film. They didn't show the two writers who were already major writers, and one was going to direct the picture, Curtis Hanson. They didn't show the studio the movie for a year. So what the studio thought they were getting that was a first draft was actually like a 21st draft. They just kept saying, yeah, it's coming. They kept saying that for a year. Now, could most of us get away with that? I doubt it. But still, the point is, keep writing.
Mm-hmm. We had a pair of writers, Paul Chitlick and Mark Scheffler, who say they've evolved a process where they get into a room, they go through the premise, they go through the basic outline, then one of them will write it, send it to the other, who will rewrite it, and they keep sending it back and forth until they just don't want to rewrite it anymore, where they finally feel like one person wrote it.
We have a question.
Yes.
I'm curious about the technical side of things, because you've got the writer's room, and they're dealing with story and character and conflict and resolution and jokes. And then you've got a show that needs to be filmed and it needs to be edited, and you've got a live audience, or in the old days used to have a laugh track. And how do the writers anticipate and deal with that technical aspect?
Well, I mean, first of all, you're starting to describe the role of the showrunner.
What?
Oh. I know how to quiet a room.
The showrunner. Well, the showrunner does everything, including run the room. Is somebody over here? So just very quickly, all of that stuff, the writers go down 4 days before the show tapes, or in these, you know, films, and they do rewrite after rewrite after rewrite. Meanwhile, everyone else is, there's a table read for all the technical people. And then they shoot. And our shows, they shoot typically in 8 days. They used to shoot them in six. Now they shoot them in 8 or 9. So The Good Wife takes much longer to shoot. Are you, yes. Okay. I was in the middle.
Nobody on the radio knew what we just did, which is hysterical.
Sorry.
Now if you laugh really, really big, then what happened? What did we miss?
In the writer's room, you've got 2, 4, 6, 8 writers, and you've got the showrunner. Who's the decider? Who's the George
showrunner.
W.
Showrunner. Showrunner.
Is not the star of the show?
No. Showrunner.
And the
star. Now, wait. To be fair, if it's a really powerful star of the show, they have a huge voice. And they, as a matter of fact, in the story we told you about Roseanne and the, well, do you want to do it or not?
Yeah.
They decided not to use that joke. Roseanne said, I want it in.
And
it was
back,
in.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, there's another story that we got that was really interesting, where on Home Improvement, they came up with an idea for a show about cancer. It's cancer on a sitcom? The network said, absolutely not. This is a sitcom. They got Tim Allen to go lobby for the episode and got it on. And it got the highest rating of any one of the Home Improvements that year. And then the network came back to the writers and said, could you give us some more cancer shows? But Jeffrey?
One back here.
You snooze, you lose.
Do you know how they write the Jon Stewart's The Daily Show? Because I get the impression that Jon Stewart is right there with the writers and they're all sort of...
He's in the room with a lot of writers.
They write it the same principle as a sitcom or a drama. They just have to do it every day as opposed to, you know, well, 13 weeks now is typical.
But if you look at the list of writers, his name is there.
Yeah, he's a writer first.
Yeah. Jeffrey, we have a question over here. I don't think it's going to be a good one, but give her a chance.
Good.
You didn't see the face she made of me
before.
Who had
their hand up?
Right here.
Okay. Would you like to go first?
No, she goes first.
Okay. All right. Good. I'm just trying to stay on script here. It's tough.
And don't throw
did you deal with solitary writers? I'm a solitary writer, obviously. Yeah.
You'll get out.
Yeah. No.
Good behavior.
Because you were asking, how do you know when it's funny? How do you know when it's funny? And I work alone, so I try it out on audiences. But what happens is that it isn't just the joke. It isn't just the words. It's how you present it and how you... I can do the same joke, and after I've done it like about 10 times, then it'll be funny.
I can do the same joke 10 different ways and make it not funny.
No, I know it wouldn't be funny. Well, that's men.
It's a gift.
Men. That's what but women can.
Anyway, it's kind of funny. I was a San Franciscan and lived with Harry Anderson from Night Court.
Oh.
And I brought this picture for people to see, and it was a laugh a minute. And I am also a comedian. I have been in the field, let's say, in acting. I'm an actor, and but now I'm into the comic aspect, and gained some knowledge from you, all of you. But anyway, I don't know if you want to show this. Homegrown boy.
He's a really sweet man, too.
And a great magician, too.
Well, that's how we started out in, the magician, the starving artist. And he went on to, as you know, become a very famous and funny star.
Talk to me after. We may know some people in comedy.
Yeah, and I need a rider. But there.
That's so funny. I was going to ask you for a ride to the airport.
Well, you might get it. But what's funny is that I do wear some outfits that draw attention to my act and me, right? When I brought this in, I really didn't realize that it was going to sing. And I know this lady wasn't too happy with me. I thought it was my phone. We were looking for the noise. And it is this tie. But it would make a funny, conflict because she's, the whole conflict about cell phones and you want to kill that person, right? Well, she was going to take that tie and wrap it around my head.
You know what's really exciting for me? I think this is a room Peter can't take back. I think I've actually met a room Peter can't take back. There's questions all over the place.
Quick question. You two are of the vintage category, but I know you know who Sarah Silverman is, and what do you think of her humor, her brand of humor?
I can't speak for Peter. And by the way, thank you for saying that I'm vintage.
You're very welcome.
I have a 21-year-old and a 24-year-old. No, I don't have any grandchildren. My children know they're out of the will if they marry before 35. So... I love Sarah Silverman. I think she's brave. I think she's funny. And I think she's an original. And I also love her politics. So I love everything about her. She's
for the record, she's one of my heroes. She's great.
She's really brave. But I'm still devastated about the breakup with Jimmy Kimmel. I can't get over it. Well, that's class. They're classy. You know, Eddie and Debbie didn't talk about it either. It's just everybody else. So you said I was vintage. I'm making an old reference.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and Show Me the Funny, How Hollywood's Top Comedy Writers with Jeffrey Davis and Peter Desberg.
So we want to make a little point. Oh, another question.
Well, it's a quick comment because you were lamenting the laughing here, but you did ask us to turn off our phones.
I did not lament laughter.
We did not ask. We demanded. There's a difference. Once.
Please, don't be shy. You know, we're not.
There's another one.
Tell us about any experiences you had where you rewrote and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote and you were right on the market and it was really funny after the halfway through it and you blew it by going on.
You know, I mean, one of the interesting things when you're writing comedy is the smallest little difference can totally change something. A little pause and it takes so little to make something funny sometimes. Let me go on for a second here and explain something, and maybe it'll give you a little bit of an answer to it. First, interesting question, Jeffrey. In comedy teams, who gets paid more?
The straight man.
And you wonder why, and the answer is because Jeffrey said so. In addition, it's punches are easy. Setups are hard. And good comedy writing has nothing to do with punches. It has to do with setups. We just came up with a couple of examples here for you. Can you all read this?
Sure.
Cover your right eye. If you can't read this, you shouldn't be driving home. Yeah, so?
Try working
with that.
Wait.
We fixed this when you weren't looking because we knew there was going to be a pet in the room. And your appreciation is to impugn us by thinking that it's an error. Now, I'm going to let it go, but we worked this hard for you. All we expected was a little light petting. When you control the keyboard, you control everything. Now the question is, will we save it?
I thought it was
going to
be
accept. So now here's a tawdry little joke, but I could take this joke very easily and say, totally changes the character of the joke. Same setup, different punch.
You people are so easy.
Move closer. So, again, everything is in the setup. Let me see how
Excuse me, we need you to read one out loud.
It says, you should make it a point to try every experience expect incest voting in Arizona.
You don't know how many times we rehearsed that, too.
How are we doing on time? Are we good? You know what? Should we teach them a little about joke switching?
I think you just did.
Yeah. No. We could go.
Would you like to learn about joke switching?
We think it'd be nice if we gave you a skill by the time you went home, besides just disliking us. That's not really a skill. It's more of an aptitude.
Well, as people who dislike us, it is finely honed skill, I would think.
So we gave you an example of joke switching before by, I'm thinking. So joke switching is taking a joke and kind of changing it but keeping the joke the same. I'll give you an example. Old joke, guy goes to a cemetery, sees a tombstone. It says, here lies a lawyer and an honest man. So he goes up to the caretaker and says, hey, since when have you been burying people two at a time? Doesn't seem like a big joke, not particularly useful. Do you really want to remember it? Oh, yeah. Because the Dictionary of Occupational Titles has about 20,000 entries. Want to hear a joke about an accountant or a plumber? Guy goes to a cemetery. See? So once you can learn to switch jokes, you hear one joke and it can become omni-applicable. And when I watch sitcoms, when Jeffrey watches sitcoms, we can tell you the history of two-thirds of the jokes there because we've seen them before and seen how they're transmogrified. It's a very nice, useful skill. Let me give you what for me was a very interesting example of switching. I went to the coach of our university baseball team. Bob, I got a joke for you. A rich Arab oil sheik decides he wants to do something nice for his sons. So he brings the first one in and says, you know, I got all this money. Let me do something for you. What would you like? He says, well, Dad, I've always wanted to learn how to sail. Could you give me a little single mast sabot? Buys him the QE3. Second son, what can I do for you? He says, Dad, I'd love to learn how to fly. Could you give me a little single engine Cessna? Buys him a Concorde jet. Third guy comes in and says, well, what would you like? He says, Dad, I just came back from Southern California. I went to Disneyland. Could you give me a little Mickey Mouse outfit? So he bought him the Dominguez Hills baseball team. This coach started to cry, smash himself in the thigh, was and when finally breathing came back to normal, he said, where did you ever hear a joke about the Dominguez Hills baseball team? He didn't understand joke switching.
How about some other kind of jokes, Peter, that we learned in the book? This book called Show Me the Funny.
Well, there's a fellow that some of you may have heard, Dimitri Martin, a very funny stand-up comedian, who had a great line. He said, I just got a new apartment. I live in New York, and I got an apartment right around the corner from Carnegie Hall. Which is great, because now when somebody says, Dimitri, how do I get to your new place? Oh, practice, 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 then turn left. The world's oldest joke. Tourist goes up to a New Yorker, says, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. There's a simple joke. Let's try a simple switching exercise, which is we're going to keep the punch. We're going to change the setup. So the trick here is, what makes this joke work structurally is, Carnegie Hall is a place, but it's also something to which you aspire. So how could we change that joke, keeping the punch but changing the setup? Just yell something out.
I didn't get an orgasm. Practice.
I like that.
There's no way to top that.
We're going to have that requeat.
How do you get an orgasm? How does a woman have an orgasm? Practice, practice, practice.
Notice the key to that joke was she didn't say how many people were in the room.
That's men for you. They're dreamers.
Another way is keep the setup, change the punch. So we could easily have said, tourist goes up to New Yorker and says, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Sleep with the booking agent. different take, still making fun. But the ultimate way to do it is keep the idea of the joke, change the build-up, change the punch. So what you really want to do, the key again to the joke, is pick something that's a place and a quick straw poll here so we know what kind of joke we can tell. How many Republicans do we have here?
Really? Still?
How many? Whoa. How many Democrats?
Really?
Whoa. Let's hear the other. How many Democrats do we have here?
Okay.
And some people are still undecided. Can you believe that? So let's say we wanted to take a political figure and make fun of him. So we could say something like, I'll give you the setup. You can give me punches. How do I get to RNC headquarters? Change your pitch every 10 minutes. Agree with whatever the president said last week. So you could take any trait, anything. So this becomes a very powerful joke, because whoever I want to make fun of, I've got a vehicle here, and I can do it. Who wants to take a shot at one?
Oh, it's suddenly turned into a funeral party.
You know, on the way home, you're going to say, oh, I got a great one.
I think.
All right. So basically, you know, when you're doing comedy, one of the main things is you have to sort of think of yourself as a magician. That, you know, what you see a magician do is he's waving his hand around here while he's palming the card down here. The classic misdirection, that it looks like this. All the action is happening down here, but you're looking over here. And that's the same basic thing that you want to do in a joke. And whether it's a simple joke or a complex joke, it's all distraction. And so you take them down one way so you can go the other. Yes, sir.
The question is,
loud.
My question is, I love comedy, and I love to listen to it on late night TV, and I can't get into David Letterman from day one. I don't understand his comedy. Could you explain it?
To me, the analogy is you're either a Barbara Streisand person or a Bette Midler person. I don't think you can be both. And I think it's the same with Letterman and Leno. You either like Leno or you like Letterman. I think David Letterman's humor is a little more risque, a little edgier, and not polite. He's not necessarily polite with guests, although he's gotten better since the heart operation. But I have the opposite reaction. I find Jay Leno absolutely the dullest comedian on the planet.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. When you say, do you say that you don't follow it or you don't think it's funny?
I can laugh out loud while laying in bed, I've never done that. Okay,
so
really, he obviously.
Well, maybe you want to sit. Maybe you want to listen to Leto sitting. You know, listen to him sitting up.
You should ask my wife about that.
But you know, a big part of this, you know, when you're dealing with a joke, is understanding the reference behind it. What's the assumption of the joke? You know, if I say, "Hey, Tuesday night." We're all in there with the family, and Uncle Gene puts this lampshade on his head and he starts dancing around it. No, but if you knew Uncle Gene, it's really funny. You know, you don't know Uncle Gene. It's not funny. You have to know the referent. And certain jokes, you know, I'll give you an example of I'm going to tell the Eleanor Roosevelt joke.
5 minutes.
I just heard this joke the other day. You'll tell me if it's funny. Eleanor Roosevelt goes in to see FDR and says, "Honey, do you notice anything different about me tonight? New dress, honey? No. New earrings? No. New shoes? No, silly, I'm wearing a gas mask."
See, I told you, Peter.
Wait, give him a chance to get it first. Give him a chance.
You know, we all have that reaction. First of all, we love Eleanor Roosevelt, and you're insulting a hero. question over here, ma'am. We have about 5 minutes,
that's
so
like
we'd like
John
to.
That's like the John Kerry joke. John Kerry walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "Why the long face?" You got to see Hyde Park on the Hudson.
Oh, I hear it's great.
Bill Murray's imitation of FDR and Eleanor, and FDR, as you know, practiced incest with his fifth. He wasn't sure. Sixth cousin.
Yes.
And it revolves around that, and also there's some folk dancing.
And I would like to recommend to everyone to run and see Helen Mirren and Anthony Hopkins and Hitchcock. It's fabulous. I loved it.
Okay.
Okay, you're right, because you're
a couple of quick words of advice. If you happen to meet a stand-up or a comedy writer, please don't go up to them and say, "Have I got a funny joke for you?" It's basically like meeting Placido Domingo and say, "You know, I sing a little too. Want to hear a tune?"
Can I do the turnaround joke as a close?
Yes, it's about time.
It is my favorite kind of joke. How many people have seen A Christmas Story? You know how the dog eats the turkey and the father says, "Oh, no, we're not going to the Chinese restaurant again." And the next scene, boom, you're in the Chinese restaurant. That's a turnaround joke. And you always know that you can get a laugh on it. And you see it on every sitcom. Sooner or later, we'll do the turnaround joke. And what's the joke, Peter, that people do tired and they want to go home?
Turnaround jokes. Really, every time you see one of those, you know, you're not going to get me to go to my mother-in-law's house. Hi, Mom. Every time, you know, it was 5:30, they're looking at the clock, we need one more joke to wrap this up, I can't think of anything, can you? Turnaround joke. You know when you see one of these, some writer was hungry. And on that happy note.
Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our program. And our thanks to...
Oh, how charitable of you. Thank
you. Just feeling sorry.
Sorry, and just remember that we still have college-age children when you go out.
Our thanks to Peter Desberg and Jeffrey Davis for a wonderful evening. Stay tuned in. After all, Peter and Jeffrey still have that long-running Washington sitcom called The Fiscal Cliff to talk to us about, where no one wants to save their money. I'm Ann Clark, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than 100 years of enlightenment and discussion in the know is coming to an end. I actually personally want to thank Kevin O'Malley, who's the chair of the Business and Leadership Program. The Business and Leadership Program under Kevin's sponsorship actually sponsored the program tonight. So we owe Kevin and the Business and Leadership Program a big debt. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is officially over.